Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today, Joanna Sokol, has worked on a 911 ambulance for 10 years.
On the beach in Santa Cruz, in the high desert of Reno, and on the steep streets of San Francisco. Before that, she spent time as a ski patroller, wilderness EMT, and medical standby for raves and music festivals. And in this book, Real Emergency Stories from the Ambulance, she talks about all of those times and places. Joanna holds a paramedic license and a bachelor's degree in biological sciences from the University of California at Santa Cruz. And her literary work has appeared many places. She received a Sydney Award in 2019, and she currently lives in Santa Cruz. And I've assuming is still working on the ambulance. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Joanna.
Good morning. Thank you.
Are you still working as an EMT?
No, I actually got out of the field a year or two ago. I piled up one too many injuries.
Oh, wow.
I'm teaching EMTs and paramedics right now.
Oh, wow. So I bet you could write a whole book about that.
Oh yeah, it's a whole new journey. Yeah. Learning how to be good at that.
So, a real emergency, you started writing down these incidents as they occurred pretty early on, didn't you?
Yeah. I have kept journals since I was a little kid. I've always been a journaler. So when I'm going through something interesting, or when I'm stressed out, or when I'm confused and don't know what to do in life, I turn to my notebook and I just write it all down. And so my first couple of years on the ambulance, I was having all these new experiences. I was really anxious about whether I was doing a good job or not. I was learning a lot. And so I just started continued keeping journals. And I wrote down what was happening. And pretty much most paramedics either keep a little notebook, or we'll actually write on our gloves and Sharpie during a call. We write down the patient's vital signs, their name, if they have any allergies, you know, we'll take a quick note. And I found myself, I carried little notebooks in my back pocket, and I found myself almost involuntarily writing down like the little details about the call. You know, it would be the patient's like blood pressure, their heart rate, and then like something funny that they said to me, or like a silly hat that they were wearing, you know, and I just kind of started gathering information. I couldn't help it.
At what point did you realize there was a book in this?
Very late, not till the last couple of years. I had, you know, mountains of journals, but I've always had mountains of journals my whole life. So I would just kind of throw them on the pile when I filled one. And it was maybe 10 or 12 years into my career, I wrote a couple of essays. I had a good friend who worked at a literary magazine, and we were talking about the job one day, and she was like, wow, that's really interesting. You should write an essay about that. And she actually really helped guide me into like how to form my thoughts into a little essay. And that was really fun. And so we did two of those working together. And then maybe a year or two after that, I started to really sort of collect things and realize, you know, oh, there's actually a lot of material here. Wow. We might have a whole live book.
Had you said you always kept a journal. Were you always thinking that maybe someday you'd be a writer?
So my mother is a writer. My mom's a journalist. Lot of long form magazine writing and hard copy news. And it was very important to me to not follow in her footsteps.
Well, that didn't work out so well.
I joke now that I spent the first 37 years of my life trying really hard not to turn into my mom. And my mom's amazing. It's not because I don't love her. She's incredible. We're actually really close, but she casts a wide shadow. You know, she has a big personality and she's really good at what she does. And it was really important to me to like find my own path. And so I wasn't going to be a writer like my mom, and I wasn't going to be a lawyer like my dad. I was going to go do my own thing. And so the whole time that I was taking all these notes and writing down stories, it was always just for me. It was like a secret. It was like, no, it's not a book. I'm not a writer. This is just kind of my own personal secret hobby that I do. I'm a paramedic, you know, I'm a science person and an adrenaline person, and this is what I do. And it was very important to me that I not consider myself a writer, even though I was keeping like hundreds of pages of journals.
Well, you must have gotten over that at some point.
Yeah, no, I hit a certain age and I kind of threw in the towel.
That's so funny because it's kind of the opposite of most people, you know?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe the case.
Yeah.
No, that was my experience. And you know, it's not to say that the book was easy. The book was really hard. And I think part of why I didn't want to think of myself as a writer is that I knew how hard it is to actually be a professional writer. You know, I saw it firsthand growing up. I knew how exhausting and how emotional the process was. And I was like, ooh, I don't want to do that. and so, yeah.
You know, it's funny because I'm an entrepreneur and an accountant, and my daughter growing up decided, you know, she did not want to do that because she saw how hard that was.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what she always said. And guess what? She's now working with me.
Yeah, totally.
She's now my chief, my vice president of finance.
Yeah.
For my company.
I tried really hard not to turn into a writer, and you know, it didn't take. So. Here we are.
There's just not much you can do about it. But how did you get into the EMT field? Because that does seem like quite a stretch from your upbringing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of medics grow up in families of like nurses, firefighters, police. And so it's kind of a natural fit. I always think there's kind of two genres of medics. There's kids that were born into it. Their parents, like I said, nurses, firefighters, cops. And then there's kids who fall into it because they tried to do some other stuff and it didn't work, and they realized that they were crazy people and they were going to be miserable in any other job. And so I always really loved science and medicine. And like I said, I wanted to like carve my own path. I figured I would go into something sciencey or medical. I went to university. I went to a really like prestigious, rigorous program, and I really liked the material, but I hated sitting still. I found out very quickly that I had a really hard time sitting in a chair and sitting in a library all day studying when there was like a whole big wide world out there of colors and music and people and mountains. And so I kind of dropped in and out of university. I left for a year. I went back. The second time I dropped out, I took an EMT class at a local community college. And the theory was, that looks cool. that was basically the amount of knowledge I had going into it. I was like, well, emergencies are cool, you know, I like adrenaline and science and stuff. And so I went into the class, and a couple days in, I was like, oh, this is the thing. This is what I'm doing. I got along with the people. I love the immediacy of it. You know, you get right in there. The initial training that it takes to get on an ambulance is actually really limited. EMT class is like a semester. And then if you choose to become a paramedic, that's another couple years of school. It's a lot more intensive. But to just get you out there in it, it's pretty fast. You go very quickly from being like a dumb 19-year-old to having your hand holding bleeding on somebody's leg. And I love that. That really appealed to me. I love the idea that you're out there in the world helping people with your hands. You're using your body. You know, you're not sitting behind a screen. You're actually like out in streets and hotels and houses talking to people and using your hands to help them out. It really appealed to me.
Now this book, A Real Emergency, Stories from the Ambulance, is it's your memoir, but it also delves into history, the history of ambulance system, kind of the socio-political environment that you're operating in, and you're telling stories in other people's voices as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you decide to broaden it in that way?
It's a great question, and it's one that nobody's asked me yet, actually, but it's very personal. I've been in the field, I did about 14 years in the field as an EMT and a paramedic, and it's such a big, complicated, intense world right now that not a lot of people actually know much about. People tend to have some knowledge about how hospitals and ERs work. and about how the police and fire department work. But ambulances are really kind of this like weird sort of hidden gray area. And the politics and the history is really complicated. And I said for years, I think there is a book out there that someone should write that's like a big, thick, intense, complicated, heavily researched like tome about how the EMS system actually works and how it came to be. And I knew that I didn't want to write that book, you know, that I think someone should, honestly, I would read it. I think some of us would read it. I think not that many people would read it. And so when I first started, I was really, really confused for the first year of writing. I was actually really undecided about how much extra information I wanted to wanted to add, whether this was just going to be a memoir with personal stories that's like, here's my experience on the ambulance, or whether I was going to include some research. And I started reading years ago, history of how ambulances came to be and why the system is so screwed up and why it is the way it is. And I found such cool stories that the more I read about it, the more I was like, okay, I have to include some of this stuff. I can't not tell any of these stories. And I wasn't going to spend, I didn't have the budget or the skill set, quite frankly, to spend like 5 years traveling around the country, interviewing everybody and CEOs and politicians and doing like a comprehensive history of EMS. But I wanted to include some of the stories just because they're so cool. They're so interesting. And as I got deeper and deeper into the book, I realized, okay, I sort of got more ambitious as the book went along. And I felt capable of adding more in. And so as the book went along and as I had more time to do the research and really back it up, I started to build confidence and build some ambition to put more of those stories in. And you mentioned the other people's voices. That was really one of the things that kind of blew open the book for me. I was interviewing, it didn't even start as formal interviews. It started with Mikey, right? I talk about him a lot in the book. He's one of my best friends on the ambulance. He was my first serious long-term partner on the ambulance. We worked together when I was a brand new baby medic, and he became family to me. I mean, we're still family. I go up and visit him, you know, every couple months. We're very close. And I wanted his perspective as I went into writing this book, because I am often wrong, you know, and sometimes my memories are wrong and sometimes I'm dumb about things. And I wanted to get the perspective of somebody else in the field who I really respected and who I looked up to as a clinician and I knew really well, just to kind of check myself. It was almost like a journalist will, you know, have multiple sources for the same piece of information. I was like, I want to make sure I'm not screwing this up. And so I asked Mikey, and I reached out to Dan Quino, who is another one of the voices in the book. And he's been a supervisor for like 40 years. He was there right when the ambulances started. And it was some of the conversations with Mikey that I was having where I knew I was going to quote him in the book and I was going to use him as a character. And I don't remember which one it was now, but he told a couple stories that were just so good. And I love the way he talks. I love the way he tells stories. I love the things that he says. You know, he has such a funny way of talking sometimes. And I was like, I don't want to quote this. I just want to print this whole story word for word. You know, I want to have pages of my book that are in Mikey's voice. And I sort of had this vision of these voices from the field and of having passages in the book that weren't in my voice. They were in other people's voices. And I loved it because, as I said, like I'm one person. I have one perspective, you know. Wanted to do that and I could do it. It really blew the book open. I was like, okay, I'm actually going to go do interviews. I'm going to include passages in other people's voices. I'm going to include these things from history. It's not just going to be me and my personal story. We're actually going to talk about EMS as a whole a little bit here.
Wow. That probably meant it took longer to write by doing that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had 6 months, maybe a year kind of budgeted for and blocked off. It ended up taking closer to 2 years. You know, that's been tough financially, but I'm really glad I was able to do it. It also just meant I worked a lot harder. You know, I'd been in the field, like I said, I'd been working since I was a teenager, and for years I always had this idea that someday I was going to take a year off and just like surf and walk my dog and hang out, you know, chill out somehow. And I'd been putting away money for a long time. And then once I realized I might be able to do a book, it was like, that's going to be the thing. I'm going to take a year off. I'm going to chill out, heal my injuries, walk my dog, write this book, you know, take time off. And so I was saving up money for it for years and years. And then when it finally came and I realized I was going to do the research and the interviews and stuff, it was like, oh, I'm actually going to work this year too. Oh. it's not going to be all playtime, you know, we're actually going to be traveling around doing interviews and triple checking sources and piling up books that I've read about, you know, ancient ambulance history.
So you mentioned healing from injuries. Were these injuries you got on the job?
Yeah, absolutely. The ambulance is really physically demanding. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is the ways that the ambulance is really different from a firehouse. In some rural areas, the medics still have stations where they can like hang out and recuperate between calls. But most urban areas these days are so busy that we don't actually have stations anymore. They took those away. We just drive around in the ambulance for 12 or 16 hours. All day. It's all night. You know, when you work a night shift on the ambulance, you don't actually get a cot to take a nap in. You're just in a van from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And in between calls, so you're running, the calls are really physically demanding. You're carrying people up and down stairs. I worked in San Francisco. It's very hilly. So everything is stairs. And a lot of the buildings either don't have elevators or the elevators are broken or they're too small to fit a gurney. So you're running upstairs at 3 a.m. carrying all your gear, and then you're helping somebody out because they're stuck behind the bathtub. And then maybe you're doing chest compressions. Maybe you're helping them out of their wheelchair, and then you're physically carrying them down like 4 flights of stairs. And then after that call, you don't get to go rest in a station and stretch your legs out. You just stuff yourself in the front cab of a van and drive to the next call. And so injuries are really, really common. We have a ton of injuries. And unfortunately, it's more about the work conditions than it is about the patients themselves. So after a few years, I piled up, my low back's messed up, my left shoulder's messed up, my right wrist is messed up. And it's really common in your late 30s to just be physically unable to withstand the work anymore. It's a really young job these days. Most medics are under the age of 35 because you just can't handle it after a certain point. And that's exactly what happened to me. I didn't have one career ending injury. I had just a big pile of injuries that built up, never really healed properly. And eventually I just hit a wall where I couldn't do it anymore.
So, and this isn't a personal question, but just in general, does workman's comp kick in well enough to help people survive after all these injuries?
Yes, we do have workman's comp. So if you get injured on the clock, what happens, it's so common that there's totally a process for it. You get injured on the clock, you go back to station, you fill out a form, and then workman's comp kicks in. And generally what they'll do is they'll put you on what's called light duty. And so you'll, for the next, while your injury heals, you'll come in 5 days a week from 9 to 5, and you'll do paperwork or answer the phones or like reorganize the supply closet or something like that. And it's so common for medics to be out on light duty that there's actually certain jobs that are just reserved for light duty medics. You know, it's like, oh, we'll just have a light duty guy do that because there's always so many of us hanging around. And so you'll go on light duty until your injury heals, and then you'll go back out into the field. And so for me, what happened is as my career progressed, eventually I was spending more time on light duty than I was on the ambulance. Mm-hmm. And light duty is no fun, you know? And I kind of looked up and I was like, do I really want to spend the next 20 years like rocking a desk? And there are ways you can promote, you know, you can get a captain's job or an instructor's job or something like that. But yeah, I got to a point where I was spending more time on light duty than in the ambulance. And I was like, okay, I think we're done here. I think it's time to call it.
Now, if it seems like a lot of the injuries may be chronic in a sense. And
yeah.
And so I know in other industries, sometimes an employee might have a hard time proving it's a work-related injury because there isn't a single event that causes the injury.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I should mention too that it is possible to get medically retired, to have one injury that's so severe and so dramatic that you can never go back in the field. And that process is really intense. It takes it's 2 years before they even give you any money. You have court dates. There's like investigators involved. They come check up on you for years afterwards to make sure that you're like still injured. You don't end up, I think you get 50% of your pay. And then you're not allowed to work on top of that. So it's a whole, you can get medically retired. That does happen, but it's kind of rare and it's like a really intense process. And in terms of making sure that you're actually injured, what I found, I think it's really different depending where you work. So I don't want to make a statement that's too general. What I found in my personal experience was if you have an injury that's going to take you a couple weeks and all you're going to do is go on light duty and then go back into the field, I found the process wasn't that intense because it's so common. You know, a workers' comp guy calls you, you do this interview that's like 30, 40 minutes where they're like, are you sure you didn't do this dirt biking on your weekend? And you're like, yeah, it was at work. And then they're like, all right, fine. But if you're going to get surgery or if you're talking about medical retirement, then there is like an investigative process that's a lot more in depth where they'll actually kind of check up on you and make sure that you're not faking it. But if you tweaked your back and you're going to rock a desk for a few weeks and then go back into the field, at the fire department where I was working, it was not that big of a deal because it was so common.
Right, right. Now, a lot of what you write about is how different the actual practice of this is from what people think it is based on TV shows where everything's this emergency, this life-saving situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So was that a surprise to you when you started working?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. When you're in school, you learn the training's really intense. It's really fast. And you learn how to stop bleeding. You learn how to open airways. You know, your patient's not breathing. Here's six different things that could be wrong with them and how to address those. Here's how to stop their bleeding and get them to the hospital. And you learn about heart attacks, strokes, cardiac arrests, traumas, burns. And then you get into the field and your first patient has a tummy ache that's been going on for like 3 weeks and it's got a little worse. And they don't really want to pay to go to a doctor. So they just kind of want you to fix it. And you're like, I don't know how to do this. And then your next patient after that is a homeless gentleman who's been drinking for a few days. And the shopkeeper whose store he lives in front of got really annoyed with him and is like, can you deal with this, please? And he's on the street and he's just like, I'm fine. Go away. And you're like, what? This isn't bleeding either. I don't know how to deal with this. And then your next patient after that is like a grandma who just got sent home from the hospital with a really confusing new medication regimen and she doesn't know what pills she's supposed to take. And then that goes up for your first like 50, like 40 or 50 patients. It's basically, I would say roughly 4 or 5, and I've read a little bit, this number is backed up, roughly 4 or 5% of our calls are like real live lights and sirens, like, oh crap, this guy's gonna die in the next 10 minutes, emergencies. And the other 95% are people who are either poor, homeless, they have addiction or chronic medical issues. They don't have a primary care doctor because their insurance just got taken away, but they just need someone to take a look real quick. You know, 911, it isn't free, but it kind of is, because when you call 911, we don't take your credit card information over the phone, right? We send someone out and then we send you a bill later in the mail. And most people don't end up paying that bill. And so, and whether you pay your bill or not, you can have, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in unpaid medical bills. And if you call 911, we're still going to send someone. You never get your service cut off. And so as a result of that, we're fast, and you don't have to pay up front. And we're going to come every time, no matter what. If you're super, super mean to us and you spit on us and you try to stab us, we're still going to show up, right? If you don't have a real medical complaint and you just called us to turn the lights on and off because you didn't want to get up, the next time you call us, we're still going to show up. And so what that means is that the vast majority of our calls aren't for quote unquote real emergencies, and they're never going to be. it's built into the 911 system that we're going to end up being a safety net for all of the problems that society or can't or won't deal with in other ways. And that's just, that's a really base part of the ambulance that you learn very quickly when you start the job.
And it seems from reading your book that although you don't like that fact, in some ways you were proud to be that person who was the—
Yeah, that's really well put.
The person of last resort for all these people. Yeah.
No, that's really well put. I am proud of it. And it makes the work really frustrating and often really tedious. And you have days where you're like, what the heck am I doing here? Like, this isn't what I signed up for. But at the same time, like you said, I actually am really proud of it. I think it's really cool that exists in society, that there is someone that you can call that's going to show up every time, no matter what. And to be that person, to be the guy that shows up when no one else will, I actually am really proud of it. I think there's honor in it. I think it makes the day-to-day work really frustrating and not always fun, but I think it's really cool that we do it. And so that is something that I struggle with a lot emotionally for my whole career and to this day, you know, and teaching. I try to tell the kids what this job really is. And I'm like, I still think someone should do it. You know, I still think it's really cool that you guys want to do this. I don't want to discourage you from doing this, but I do want you to have a realistic understanding of what this is, yeah, you know, and what you're getting yourselves into.
Yeah. You know, you look around at all the problems in the world and the people who just have no resources, no ability, yeah, no, you know, just such what we consider sad lives. And if I had to think that nobody was helping them, I don't know if I could continue, you know? So yeah, knowing that there is somebody out there who's doing this work makes it easier for me to go on with my life.
Yeah, and it's tough. We usually aren't going to have the resources to actually fix any problems, you know?
Yeah.
All we can really do is take someone to the ER, which is not going to fix their life. It's not going to get them safe housing. You know, it's not going to get them off the meth. But we're still going to show up and we're going to be nice and treat them like a human, you know? And I think there's value in that. I really do.
Yeah. Well, you write this one story in here about a friend from high school that was on the street, and you know how you tried to help him. And you know, in the end, like you said, there wasn't much you could do really, but you did it, but you did something.
No, that's a really tough one. That was one of the hardest stories to write, for sure. I had a friend that I grew up with who basically descended into schizophrenia and drug use and ended up out on the street with the rest of my patients. And I ran into him a few times and was trying to figure out what to do. And like you said, we weren't able to get him up out of it. You know, I didn't have the resources to single-handedly like take his hand and pull him from the darkness and like get him back to being okay. But, you know, I talked to him. We hung out for half an hour, gave him some blankets, tried to just be a person. And I have to tell myself at the end of the day that there's value in that, that some good comes of just being respectful and hanging out, even when you don't have the resources to like actually fix anything.
Oh, I think that's really true. And this is, you know, in a very little way, one thing that I try and do when I encounter homeless people is just look them in the eye and greet them instead of turning my head.
That's nice.
It's not really helping them, but I feel like so many people just turn away and don't acknowledge that that's a human person being standing there.
I'm reminded of later on in my career, I ended up spending about 2 years working for a community paramedicine program, which basically there's a big push in EMS these days to try to build these programs. Traditionally, we just take everyone to the emergency room. It's the only thing we're allowed to do is we do assessment, we do some treatment, and everybody goes to the ER. And there's been a big push lately in the last maybe 10, 15 years to try to create programs where medics can do other stuff. We can take people to urgent care. We can take them to rehab. So I was part of this program in San Francisco that was focusing specifically on mental health in homeless and unhoused patients. That's how they say it in San Francisco. And people who are out on the street having like psych breakdowns. There's a lot of meth in San Francisco, and there's a lot of people having really, really loud, aggressive breakdowns and psychosis like out on the street in everybody's face. And we would have all of, and so one of the people we worked with a social worker and a peer crisis counselor, somebody who had lived experience with homelessness or mental illness. And we often went and talked to people, we interacted, we would try to verbally de-escalate. Sometimes that works, a lot of the time it doesn't. And we kind of went in with these big ideas that we were gonna get everyone into housing, or we were gonna get them into like mental health facilities, and we were gonna fix these big problems. And of course that didn't end up coming true, because that's not how that works. A lot of the time we would just talk to people, and then they either wouldn't wanna go or there wouldn't be a facility open. And then we would walk away, and I would feel really rejected. I'd be like, nah, like this program sucks. I didn't do anything. That's dumb. And the social worker and the peer counselor would have to tell me, they'd say, no, 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 we did help. Like, and especially one of the peers that I worked with had been homeless herself. She'd been out on the street. She'd been put on mental health holds. And she would say, Joe, you don't understand how much it helps to just have someone talk to you like you're a person. Like, even though we didn't place that woman just now, we still helped her have a better day. Like, you have to understand how big of a difference that makes. And I was always kind of a brat. I was like, no, like we didn't fix everything, therefore, you know, and they would have to talk me into it over and over again. Like, no, you actually are helping.
You know, you really have seen the problems on the underside of our society. Do yeah. you have any solutions?
You know, I really wish I did. I really wish that I could use my little 15 minutes of fame from the book to be like, here's the answer. You guys all just didn't know it yet. And then we would fix everything. No, I think there's little things that can be done. You know, I think we can help with staffing. I think we can help with logistics. I think we can help medics get hurt less often. I think we can help some homeless people get some of the care that they need. But unfortunately, I don't think there's a quick fix. I don't think there's like one solution that's going to magically fix everything. I wish I had.
Well, you talk about the different ways that our emergency services are funded or not funded, as the case may be. But which do you think is the better way? I'm not going to say best, but the better way of the ways yeah. that it's being done.
There's basically, so over history, one of the things I thought was really fun was learning the different ways that ambulances have been funded. And they've been funded in the last couple hundred years by, there's been volunteer departments. There's been nonprofit, like charitable organizations. Some have been run by police departments. Some have been run by fire departments, sometimes public health departments, sometimes hospitals. Sometimes privately owned hospitals, sometimes the funeral homes ran the ambulances for a while. We have privately owned companies that do it for a profit. We have publicly traded for-profit companies. So I could go on. The point is they've been run by like every possible entity that could take this on. And so far, every single one of them has taken it on and has eventually been like, ugh, this loses money and it's really hard. Never mind, we're not doing it. Like, ambulances lose a lot of money. They're not a profit. They're really, really hard. They're hard to do in a way that's safe. And so the most common ones in the US these days, there's kind of three ways they work. One is just privately owned companies. That's really common. Those are all over the place. In a lot of places, they're run by the fire department. And increasingly, rarely there's occasional what we call a third service department, where they're actually run by the government as like a third branch. So you've got police, fire, and then the ambulance. That's why it's the third service. And historically, everybody kind of knows that those ones were the best ones to be a paramedic. A lot of the older medics that I talked to for the book say the third services were great. They were career jobs. You get benefits. You get a government pension, you get a decent workload. And whereas at the fire department, you're generally going to get kind of kicked to the side because their main focus is always going to be fires. And so the ambulance is sort of this side project that they take on. And some fire departments do really good jobs, some do a really bad, but you have to focus. It's always going to say fire department first on the t-shirt. You know, it's not going to say, like, we joke about the San Francisco EMS department that would have like that, like, does fire on the side. You know, it's never going to be that way. And then the private companies, some of them, we all like to crap on the fire, on the privates, right? It's like a running joke in the ambulance. It's like, oh, at least it's better than the privates, right? Because they're trying to create a profit off of a fundamentally unprofitable venture. And so the way they do that is by understaffing, like as and paying their medics really poorly and treating their medics really poorly. That's the only way to scrape out a profit, to make the company viable. And so we all kind of dream about the third service days when it was actually like a government-run, government-funded program. Unfortunately, it's really expensive and it's still not a perfect solution. You know, Canada, they have all publicly funded government-run ambulances, and they their medics get treated better for sure. It's a much better job, but they still have all the same problems we do. They still have, you know, 95% of their calls are not emergency. They have long wait times. They never have enough staffing. They have long wait times at hospitals. You know, they have a lot of the same problems as us. It doesn't magically fix it. It just makes it a little bit better.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Joanna Sokol, author of A Real Emergency: Stories from the Ambulance. Joanna, could you read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. So we're going to jump in kind of in the middle of the prologue. I think it's encephalitis, she tells me, because it hurts back here in my neck. The woman motions to the back of her hairline, which is grayed and dry. Susan is 70 years old and called 911 today for a runny nose and some neck pain. She's been sick for several days but hasn't seen a doctor. She lives in a single-room occupancy government assistance high-rise downtown, where she shares a small room with a younger woman she tells me is her friend. We're in San Francisco, where ancient tenement-style hotels are crammed next to new money high-rises, condos, and row houses. A tipsy young couple might walk an extra few blocks to avoid a neighborhood like Susan's. She wears an oversized orange sweater and unravels one sleeve with her thumbs as we talk. The sweater isn't as dirty as a lot of clothes worn by the people we treat, but it's not clean. I take Susan's vital signs and hook her up to the cardiac monitor. I turn the heat up in the ambulance. Susan is like most of my patients, lonely, destitute, and nursing a minor medical complaint. On a TV screen, paramedics are always rushing to try to save a woman crushed under a building, a man bleeding out, or a baby taking its last breath. There are a lot of sirens, a lot of shouting, and the occasional goofy drunk for comic relief. But the bulk of the job is invariably depicted as an adrenaline rush. The truth of my work is both more and less interesting. A paramedic today exists in a poorly defined gray area, some combination of field doctor, social worker, and street sweeper. We answer many of our calls without sirens at all and sit with people nursing complicated problems that only distantly relate to actual medicine. When we arrive at a hospital, we are rarely ushered straight to a room. We often wait with our patients for hours until a nurse has time to take over. As a street medic, I'm never going to see most patients' lab values, but I'll see the inside of their bedroom and their neighbors' bedrooms. I'll see the photos stacked in the dark corner of a closet before I'll ever see a chest X-ray. I climb my bags up three flights of stairs, past potted plants, framed certificates, and family photos. I know which houses have illegal back units, which have meth labs, which have a beautiful rooftop deck. I look in the fridge for insulin. A patient directs me to her closet to pick out a jacket to wear to the emergency room. She doesn't like the yellow one. Grab the blue one behind it. A Vietnam infantry hat falls as I reach for the hanger. She tells me to put it back. It was her husband's once. The edges of the hat are worn thin. I see moldy kitchens, rotted attics. I leave food out for pets, switch off lights, turned down the stove under a pot of oxtails. Once I read half a poem left in a dead woman's typewriter. We call it the scene. What is the scene like? Is the scene safe? Are we at a house, a clinic, an alleyway behind a row of dumpsters? Ambulance services, at their core, are about transportation. We do a lot of assessment and a little bit of intervention, but our main function is to get people from wherever they are over to the hospital. In a normal month, I run on roughly between 70 and 100 patients. Usually two or three of these are lights and sirens, step on the gas, Johnny, get the paddles type emergencies, your car wrecks, your heart attacks. The rest are people like Susan, poor, homeless, old, drunk, people who have stepped away from or been kicked out of society and don't know where else to turn for help. Overdoses always go up on the 1st and 15th. I know more about social security checks than I do about cancer, for sure. And people who have run out of resources, who are lost and scared and alone, will always vastly outnumber people who happen to be bleeding to death or having a stroke. There's just more of them. In poor communities, stable access to medicine is rare. Frequent moves mean frequent changes in insurance, Medicare eligibility, and transportation ability to a new doctor. When the food runs out, when the housing runs out, when the relationships break, we are the last resource. As long as 911 remains easy to access and fast, the bulk of our work will never be about life-threatening emergencies. I usually see each patient for an hour or two, street to hospital. We have some frequent flyers, but we only catch them on their bad days. When we don't see someone for a while, it usually means they sobered up, went to jail, or died. We arrive at the crisis point of a story, and we almost never witness its resolution. All right, we're going to skip a little and then read the last page of the prologue. Susan, the woman in the orange sweater, tells me she takes medicines for high blood pressure, psychological issues, and pain management. She's had one heart attack. She ran out of most of her medications about a week ago and hasn't been able to make it to Safeway to refill. She says she usually wheelchairs down there, but it's been cold this week. She looks up at me a little embarrassed. I didn't think they'd do anything anyway. She tells me she has some Haldol left, a common antipsychotic medication, but she doesn't always take that one because she doesn't like it. Her knees rock back and forth on the gurney, which is probably a side effect from the drug. Patients on lifelong psych meds are often a little twitchy. She tells me the blood pressure cuff feels too tight. She's been receiving disability since she was 24 or 25 for hallucinations. She was living down south back then. She spent a year in Tulsa, 2 years in Sacramento. She bounces around. She gets disability payments and welfare sometimes. I look her up on our computer system. She's been transported by us 4 times this month. As we're pulling away from our hotel, I ask her, if she's been sick all week, what was it that changed tonight to make her call 911? I keep blowing my nose, but it's still runny. When we drop Susan off at the emergency room, my partner and I both compliment her sweater. We say it looks nice on her and cozy in the winter air. She smiles broadly. I've had it for so many years, she says. It's my favorite. She pulls at the sleeves and sets her chin in the knitted bundle of cloth. I tuck in her blanket and wish her the best. I hope she gets to feeling better, gets her prescriptions sorted, and stays out of the hospital for a while. In other words, I hope I never see her again.
There we go. Thank you. That was Joanna Sokol reading from A Real Emergency, Stories from the Ambulance. So when you sat down to convert your journals into a book, what was the translation process like? Did it?
Well, I had a secret weapon. I had an incredible editor, and she's actually one of my oldest friends. That was kind of a big part of how the book came to be. It was really more of a team project than a solo. It was me and Haley doing it together. And so, one of the first things that we did is I took all of my journals, I typed up all the portions that I thought were relevant. And I usually keep handwritten, but sometimes I actually type on the laptop. And so I had some that, so I printed out everything that had already been typed on the laptop. I typed up everything I could find. And then one of the first things I did is I printed everything out. And I went over to Haley's house and we put it all on the floor. And we just started like scooting paper around all over the floor. And the dog got involved, which was not very helpful. And we were cutting things up and we were kind of organizing them. It was like, okay, here's when I worked in Reno. Here's when I worked in San Francisco. Here's like psych patients. Here's like my feelings about, you know, becoming a, and we just kind of tried to form a story. And then one of the things that I would do is I would send Haley like 60 pages of incoherent stream of consciousness word vomit. And she would read through it and she would just kind of start cutting and pasting and moving things around and circling things and crossing things out. And she would say, okay, here's your essay. Like, this is the interesting part. Talk about this and then tell the readers like how it relates to this. And I would go home and I would do my homework. And then we would kind of go back and forth, just rereading things and checking in. And I also wrote a lot more. It wasn't just from my journals. I did a lot more writing once I actually stopped and knew we were working on a book. But a lot of it actually did come from original journals. And I was just, I don't know, read it and edited it and read it again and rewrite it again. There's passages that I probably rewrote 50 or 60 times, you know, without trying. Wanted to get it right.
Is the book organized kind of roughly chronologically?
Yeah, and I really didn't want to write a straightforward chronological memoir. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is just because I'm fussy and I didn't want to. and the other is because that's not really how the job feels when you're doing it. You know, my memories of the job are really choppy. I don't remember my whole day. It's not like first we went here and then we went here. It's just kind of flashes and the order of what things happen in is really confusing. You know, I'll remember a particular street corner that I had a call on, but I couldn't tell you when that call took place. You know, I don't know. That's not how trauma memories work. And so I wanted the book to be a little bit choppy and a little bit, and I kind of joke a lot, especially with my friends, about the paramedic attention span. You know, we're not the type of people that are going to sit and read a start to finish narrative. It's just not who we are. And I wanted medics to be able to read the book. And so I really liked the idea of just different stories popping up and you read a bunch of different little stories. And then over time it gives you a more complete narrative arc. But that said, there is a narrative arc that runs throughout the collection and it is roughly chronological.
Right.
Just to make it make sense. There's a bunch of different essays and different perspectives. But we do sort of follow my career from the beginning to the end. And my growth as a person and a medic.
So you were working the ambulance when COVID hit in San Francisco.
Oh yeah.
What was that like?
Is that the question?
Yeah. No, what was that like? How did that change things?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't awesome. COVID was really loud. You know, it was a mess. It almost felt like everyone was yelling at each other for like 2 years. It was really wild working it in San Francisco because I was also working in San Francisco when fentanyl hit. And quite frankly, fentanyl actually had a bigger impact, I think, overall in like the EMS. The first year of COVID, we lost more than twice as many patients to overdoses than we did to COVID. And so it all kind of happened at the same time. The first month or two was just like really scary and intense. You know, we didn't know anything about the disease yet. It had just showed up from China. We didn't know if we were dealing with Ebola or with the common cold. We thought that maybe all of us were going to die, because the news was so confusing. And so the first month, it was very much like soldiers going to war. You know, we were really scared. We were full of adrenaline. We were like, we're going to go do this. And then it very quickly became clear that it was going to last really long and it was going to be a big giant mess. And then things, I don't want to say they settled, but it kind of turned into a grind. There were really confusing protocols. Everything was really politicized. Everyone had an opinion. Everyone was mad at each other. We were sweating. We were wearing gowns and these cheap plastic gowns and masks and eye protection for every call. And so you're just so sweaty. You feel disgusting all the time. You never really know if you're actually keeping yourself and your patients safe or not, because we don't have a sterile environment on the ambulance. You know, we kind of do our best, but
well, you're going from one call to the next so quickly. How could you possibly?
Yeah, exactly. We don't have time. And I've heard of systems where they did actually try to decon the whole rig in between calls. And they would like put it out of service for a while, but we didn't have time to do that where I worked. So we would just kind of wipe everything down and get back to work. Which is like, you know, mediocre.
Yeah.
So we didn't really know if anything we were doing was working. And meanwhile, the city was just exploding. We had tent encampments on every block outside, and everybody was overdosing left and right. And there was COVID in the tent encampments, and there was COVID in the indoor calls. And it was just really draining. It was really like emotionally draining and exhausting. And you really lose the ability to be hypervigilant all the time. You know, the adrenaline only lasts so far. And then after a while, you're just going to work. And meanwhile, everybody else in the world is talking about the lockdowns and they're at home and, you know, they're baking bread or whatever. And we're just going to work like we always have.
One of the things that really stuck out was that you had a call onto that cruise ship that was like the,
Yeah, and I had a quick chat with the lawyer about whether I was allowed to tell that story or not, you know, because we have to protect patient privacy. But San Francisco is a pretty common port area for a lot of big cruise ships. A lot of them come through the city, especially in the summertime. And so it's not uncommon for us to run those calls. And people will get sick on the cruise ships. They actually have a little, and these cruise ships are massive. I mean, a lot of them have like 3,000 to 5,000 people on them. They're huge. They're like multi-story. You know, you can see them from miles away coming into the harbor. And so they have a little mini hospital on the cruise ship and a little mini ICU. And they have like a doctor and an x-ray machine and little cots and stuff. And so it's actually not uncommon for us to run calls on the cruise ships. And the patient that we picked up from the cruise ship was not the only one that SFFD picked up from that cruise ship, which is why I was allowed to talk about it. We went and we got multiple patients because people will get sick or they'll get hurt on the cruise. They'll stay in the little, you know, mini cruise ship hospital. And then when they get into port, they'll call 911 so we can come get them off the ship and take them into a clinic or a hospital or whatever. And so, yeah, we went in, we ran a call. It was like a very uneventful, mundane call. Nothing really stood out about it besides the fact that we got to like go up the gangway and the doctor, the cruise ship doctor who handed her off was really pretty. And me and my partner were both like, she's really pretty. We like, that was like the most, that was the most dramatic thing that happened on the call. You know what I mean? That was the event of the call. We didn't think about any of the rest of it. And then a couple weeks later, COVID hit. And we found out that cruise ship had actually had positive COVID cases. And it had been one of the first people in all of California to be a confirmed case. And we were like, wait a second. Is that the ship that we were on with a really pretty doctor?
And turns out it was.
We looked back at the call. And like I said, we weren't even the only crew that went to that ship that day. You know, there were multiple crews. And we were just like, wait a second. Ah. You know, should we call someone? Like,
and you had no idea what to do.
We had no clue. And ever since we ran that call, we'd been running other calls, you know, it was like a couple weeks afterwards and we'd been on dozens of other patients since then, you know, we'd been breathing on each other and on everyone else. We weren't wearing masks yet. And so we were just like, wait a second.
And then there was,
Then it was too late. It was already here.
And then the fact that you had to keep using the same mask over and over and over and over again. Hello?
Absolutely. Okay. Are you there?
Did yes, cut I'm out? Here. We cut out for a Hello? Moment. Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Okay. Great. And the fact that you had to keep reusing the same mask.
Yeah. We did. We had the same mask. And there are these, you know, we're all familiar with N95 masks now. But they're kind of crappy masks that I'm using. If you keep using them over and over again, the paper gets really soggy and the edges start to wear out and you can't really get a seal anymore. And they just feel really gross on your face. You know, we all had these little rings of acne on our cheeks. And the thing, I had another sort of interesting run-in with the lawyer at Penguin because he was like, you don't want to make it sound like you're disparaging the fire department here, talking about how they couldn't get you the proper equipment. And it hadn't even occurred to me because I actually thought the fire department did a pretty good job. They did the best they could because the mask thing was worldwide. Nobody had enough masks.
Right.
There was this brief moment where we all freaked out and we were like, why can't we have masks? And the reason that the fire department couldn't get us enough masks is that nobody in the entire world for a minute had enough masks. We used N95s. We carried them on the ambulance before COVID. And we would use them every once in a while on patients that had pneumonia sometimes, or like MRSA, or like really nasty hospital-based infections. We would bust them out. We'd wear them. We'd throw them away. So I'd say we used them, you know, I don't know, maybe once a month. But everyone in the whole world suddenly went from wearing N95 masks maybe once a month to wearing them for every single call all day, every day. And so there just weren't enough N95 masks in circulation, you know, to suddenly produce hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them for every healthcare worker on the planet. And so, yeah, we all just kind of did the best we could. We also ran out of, a lot of stuff. We ran out of the cleaning wipes that we usually use to wipe down our stuff. Nobody could make enough of those. And so we change brands, and then we ran out of that brand, and then eventually we were just mixing our own bleach 9-to-1 ratio in a big shop sink in the garage every morning. There was just gallons of bleach, and we'd put them in little spray bottles, and they would bleach our uniforms. You know, we were used to spraying stuff down with these like antimicrobial solutions, and all of a sudden we were just using straight bleach, and so we all got these little orange bleach stains all over our uniforms.
Wow. And isn't it amazing how quickly the world has moved on from all of that?
Yeah. No, one of the weirdest things about COVID was it was really, really intense for a couple of years. And then it just kind of went away.
I know.
It was like, all right, moving on.
Yeah.
You know, and I actually wasn't super surprised by that. We had a lot of conversations early about whether this was going to like change the world or whether everyone was just going to kind of get over it and move on, you know.
It did feel at the time like it would, the world would never go back to normal. It felt like that for a long time. And to be honest, I think it really has had the most lasting effect on kids.
Yeah.
I think that the kids who were, you know, elementary school age and so forth, it really was a disruption for them.
Yeah.
In a huge way.
No, there's a ton of research about how much the young ages really make a difference. I've actually read about it in first responder trauma and mental health, the first. And yeah, I think we'll see. I think it's going to take us a long time to figure out what actually happened and how those kids end up. But yeah, I really feel for the kids. I think it was really for them to have to go through that.
Well, Joanna, I have lots more to ask you, but we're out of time. So we're going to have to wrap this up. I always close with a quote, and I chose one from Ralph Waldo Emerson. To know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, this is to have succeeded.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much for picking that quote.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy that you were able to join us today.
Me too. I really appreciate it. This was really fun. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.